call the next case, please.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Robert Thomas Payne. I'm here from the Commonwealth of Virginia Maxwell for Housing Board. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal if I may. The case before you presents Michael Fisher's now 6-year odyssey to obtain a safe parking at his condominium in Arlington, Virginia. As this case progressed, this court now faced with 4 errors that we have assigned. The first error is that in the progress of this case, the trial judge determined that she would need the Commonwealth to add the 4 individual users who acquired the use of the disabled parking spaces at Windsor Plaza condominium from its creation in 94 to the Windsor official bodies unit in 2007. After the Commonwealth added those 4 individual users, one of the users, Ms. Rossi, made a general appearance and challenged, saying that the statute of limitations had run against her, and therefore she and the other individual unit owners should be dismissed from the action. And the court granted that motion to dismiss them. We believe that was an error because the purpose of these 4 individual users to be added to the case is in the event that the Commonwealth's case against the association resulted in an outcome that would change their ability or their non-conforming use of the disabled parking spaces, the court felt that it may have to exact some relief against those 4 individuals.
So why do you name them as nominal defendants? I mean, when you filed your amended complaint, you claimed that they were discriminating against Mr. Fisher as well.
We claimed that they frustrated the association's ability to make an accommodation because their non-conforming use of those disabled parking spaces meant that there were 4 spaces. When this plaza was built, it was built subject to the design and construction provisions of the Virginia Fair Housing Law, the federal
Well, no, that all I'm saying is you named them not as nominal defendants who own the property, which I think kind of seems what was implied by the trial court judge. Instead, you claimed that they were, in fact, you know, defendants who had themselves discriminated against officials.
That may be. The purpose of naming them was merely because their non-conforming use was frustrating the association's one avenue to accommodate the Fischels in their request.
How is that true? I mean, isn't it really the fact that these were limited common elements that frustrated them? It wasn't these particular people having these limited common elements. It was the fact that they had sold them to them in the first place.
I think they were limited common elements, but when Windsor Plaza was created, the restriction that those 4 spaces be used for disabled parking was created at that moment. So when these 4 individual users acquired the use of those spaces, and the deed showed this and the court noted that acquiring that use traveled with, subject to the obligations that it be used for that restriction. And so the purpose of having those 4 spaces there is so that any disabled resident at Windsor Plaza, whether they acquired their unit before these individual users acquired the use of those spaces or after, but anyone, not just the ones in those 4 units, would have access to Windsor Plaza.
Well, isn't that completely at odds with the fact that they were limited common elements? Because at that point, when you make them limited common elements, they're going to be deeded along with a particular condo. So how could they be left open for just anybody to use?
Because they were acquired subject to the use, and I think that's where you have to say those individual users who acquired the use of those spaces did so at their own peril. The site plan made very clear that the use of those 4 spaces was for disabled parking. The spaces were situated right beside an access.
But that doesn't have to do with who owns them or who has access to them. Say, for instance, an able-bodied person had one of those that came along with their condo. And if what you say is true, it's only for able-bodied people, why couldn't they just put a rope across and says, okay, it's for handicapped people, but I'll decide which handicapped people can use it because it's my space.
Because I don't think that's consistent with how the federal and Virginia Fair Housing Law apply to those spaces. And that's the import of the design and construction subsection of the Fair Housing Law. These spaces are there so that all disabled residents whether you live in one of those four units or another unit, have access
to. So you're saying if the officials had bought one of these, anybody that wants to could still use it if they had a handicapped parking sticker?
I think if the officials had purchased their unit and a handicapped space traveled with it, they are certainly subject to use it. Now, if the other three spaces are being used...
No. How can it be that way? I mean, it seems like to me what you're saying is if the officials had bought this and it came with their unit, that any handicapped person could use it because that's the way it works.
Well, the officials have a handicapped placard on their car, so they
Correct.
Definitely could have used it.
But other people have handicapped placards, too. They could use it also?
Possibly. Until the situation where all four spaces were being used and then there was a fifth person who came along and needed use of it, at that point, somebody's going to have to request an accommodation for a fifth space. It may be that those first four unit owners who are all disabled and have access to those disabled spaces say that because of my disability, I need this to be reserved for just my use. Then the fifth person would have to ask for an accommodation that would involve the creation of an additional parking space somewhere or something similar. But I think in that situation, you don't get there until you've got that competition, basically where you have five disabled persons seeking to use four spaces. And as I mentioned, that restriction, we believe, because it is in the documents, travels at the inception of the Windsor Plaza condominium in 1994 to the present day. We don't think the trial court should have let those folks out because there was evidence that this is a continuing violation. So those folks should have remained in the trial, and then if at the end of trial on the accommodation issues, if it became apparent that the rights of those non-conforming uses would need to be corrected, at that point the court would address that issue.
Okay, but the trial court brought in the necessary parties, let them out because it said the statute of limitations applied. And so you haven't challenged on appeal its finding that they were necessary parties.
What we've challenged is they never should have been let out because they were...
So your first assignment of error?
I'm sorry?
So your first assignment of error?
The first assignment of error is that these four users were engaged in the continuing violation.
Okay, that's not my question. They were necessary parties in the trial court. You don't challenge that on appeal. They're not parties to the appeal.
Well, the one who made a general
only one is. Did. Only one is.
Right. No one else was ever properly before the trial court. They were dismissed before anyone made an appearance. No one entered appearance. No one filed a special plea in bar. No one appeared at oral argument. No one signed the order that dismissed those four persons. So we never had them properly before the trial court and those that appealed to them.
I think at one point the judge signed the order that dismissed those people.
Yes.
That's the main person who's most important in signing the order.
Right, but as far as noticing an appeal to these other three users, they were never properly before the trial court in the first place. So the Commonwealth was frustrated in being able to notice an appeal to someone who never appeared in the case below.
So you're saying that they're not necessary parties here because they were never properly in front of the trial court? That's how we judge necessary parties on appeal?
I think the way you judge it is whether they were properly before the court below.
That's the test for necessary party?
The test for necessary party is whether they're instrumental to it. I agree with that. But on appeal in Ash versus Mount Vernon Yacht Club, the issue in the court noted there was all the persons were properly before the trial court. So for the appeal, when that appeal wasn't noticed against the party that was properly before the trial court, this court dismissed that. Here, what we have is they may have been necessary parties in name at the trial level, but they were never part of that. And so when we go to notice an appeal, they were never in the case to begin with at the trial level.
Right, I understand your position.
Is your purpose for characterizing this as a necessary party to void the action at the trial court? Is that what you're trying to do?
So why
is that issue before us? I mean, as soon as Ms. Rossi comes into the case, is there any interest that any of the others have that Ms. Rossi is not capable of presenting to the court?
It depends. I mean, if Ms. Rossi was willing to go through with this, but that's what we don't know, because they were never there.
They're all situated the same way. Isn't that right? Aren't they all situated the same way?
They are in respects that they each have the use of disabled parking spaces in Windsor Plaza, but the way the facility is constructed, there's a phase one and a phase two. So some parking spaces are under one side of it and some are under the other. But other than that, I guess they would all be similarly situated.
Well, so what's the purpose of making this a necessary party issue? They were clearly proper parties. There's no question about that. But I don't understand why they're necessary parties.
They would only be necessary to the extent that at the end of the trial on the issues against the association, the trial court felt that it may have to interrupt their non-conforming use or have some other effect on their rights to use those particular limited common elements. But the trial court also, as you can see in their second and third assignments of error, there were issues that the association could have engaged in that would have accommodated possibly without interrupting these individuals' rights. But the first error the court did was determine that because the relief the Commonwealth requested, once the rules were changed regarding the use of those a new space to be created and a handicapped parking sign needed to be put up and striping made on the ground, the court then said that's a change to the premises that would make this a reasonable modification and not an accommodation. And we believe that was an error because Windsor Plaza's own policy, and it's essentially what the court did, is let them rise above their own policy, said that they can create from the general common elements disabled parking to make an accommodation for a disabled resident. And so we believe the trial court erred in converting this into a modification case because, frankly, no federal court that's looked at the issue of disabled parking has ever done that. They've all looked at, even though it may involve the reservation, placing a reserve sign or handicap sign or a disabled parking logo on that space, they've never looked at it as a modification to the premises.
I thought here the evidence was that the way this parking garage or whatever was configured, that they really would have to make some structural changes.
They wouldn't have to make any structural changes. They would have to remove a bike rack, place a disabled parking logo on the floor, and then put up a disabled parking sign.
But isn't your problem none of that is in evidence? I didn't see anything in the transcript to talk about what would have to be done to convert this to a parking space.
Well, they acknowledged in their briefs that was what would have to be done. They acknowledged first that they would have to change the site plan and the declaration, and those are the rules and policies that govern the use of the general common elements. And so that's where we get to the accommodation issue. The fact that they may have to put up signs, and Mr. Fischel said he offered to pay for placing the signage at that space.
The trial court also made a finding that he never made that specific request for the bike space.
Well, he stated
that it was never an actual request. The trial court made a finding, factual finding.
Well, the trial court, and here the standard is to look at the facts in most light and favorable to the plaintiff. But Mr. Fischel did testify that he told the building manager that there's a place where the bicycle storage was occurring that would suit him for disabled parking. And the building manager, Mr. Tilton, dismissed that out of hand, said it was too expensive or something. But Mr. Fischel, at trial, testified that he offered to pay for that signage. So even if the signage was an issue, he had offered to pay for it. But really what we're back to is the association never really engaged Mr. Fischel about providing a reasonable accommodation and looking at changes like this. It looked instead at either giving him parking outside, which was on a completely inaccessible route, or to give him basically access via a temporary swap, in which the other unit owner could at any time unilaterally end that arrangement, and Mr. Fischel would be back in the same place he is now. He wouldn't have access to his unit.
Counselor.
Yes, sir.
Even though the cost is de minimis to change the bicycle area to a parking area, it would appear that would fit within the reasonable modification, Romanet 1, because it is indeed a modification of existing premises. Your pleading pleaded Romanet 2, reasonable accommodation in rules, practices, policies, or services. What rule, practice, policy, or service was involved in that discussion?
The parking rule specifically was Policy Resolution 7, paragraph 1.3, in which the association says that the rules say that they can create a disabled parking space from a general common element, which that biking area was.
And do you have the joint appendix? And you could wait until your rebuttal time if you'd like, but I'd be grateful if you would.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
But back to the issue about modification, the association admitted in its opposing brief at page 18 that it would have to change the site plan and the declaration to effect this change. But it would have to do that first and then put up the signs to reflect the rules that affect that particular area. That's why we believe this is properly an accommodation and not a modification. They have to change the rules.
Could it not be both either? I mean, would these facts support either a finding of a reasonable modification or a reasonable accommodation? Or is it necessary to make a determination between the two?
I think had the association come back and said that we want you to pay for the sign, then we may evaluate whether placing a sign is a modification to the premises. Based on the federal jurisprudence, I would hesitate to go that far because the federal jurisprudence has really looked at the distinguishing thing. When it comes to changing the premises, these are structural changes they talk about. We talk about things being done in a workmanlike manner, putting aside a reserve to change it back if necessary. And in the jurisprudence, you see cases about adding wheelchair ramps to residences or widening doors or actually going into a bathroom and removing drywall to strengthen the structure of the wall so you can put in grab bars for people to pull themselves up. I don't think even though an accommodation may result in some de minimis expense and change to the property that's cosmetic, I don't think it reaches the level of being a modification.
Madam Chief Justice, if I may. Mm-hmm. Since you have no rebuttal time, would you be kind enough to just tell me again the site, not the page citation, but the citation?
It's the Parking Policy Resolution Number 7, paragraph 1.3 is the rule about using general common elements to accommodate disabled residents.
Okay, that's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Raymond Diaz, and I represent the Windsor Plaza Condominium Association in this matter. I propose to address first the statute of limitations question. I'd also like to talk about the modification issue, and I certainly would like to talk about the question of sovereign immunity and attorney's fees on the cross appeal. It is clearly the case here that no appeal has been taken with respect to 7 of the 8 owners of the handicapped parking spaces. The final order is concluded with respect to them and cannot be appealed. Without them before the court, it seems to me that it is impossible to deal with questions with respect to the statute of limitations decision made by the trial court that matter is precluded. I'd like to talk about the argument that the Commonwealth makes that merely by owning these parking spaces, there is a reasonable accommodation breach. The only count that was in this case went to trial, was whether or not a reasonable accommodation had been provided. The statute is reactive. It doesn't require a housing provider to do anything affirmative until they get a request, and then they must respond to that request with an accommodation that's reasonable and necessary in the circumstances. There was no evidence presented of any kind that there was a request for an accommodation made from towards these individual property owners who own the handicapped spaces. So the only theory that's left then is that these people owning the spaces somehow interfered with Windsor Plaza's ability to respond to the request for an accommodation. And so if that's the theory, then it has to be that the fault occurred in August of 07 when Windsor Plaza indicated to the Fischels that they could not provide them an accessible parking space in the garage. Clearly, that statute of limitations has expired. The Commonwealth proposes a second theory, and that is, he says, well, these limited common element parking spaces, when they were deeded to the owners, was subject to the condition that they could be used only as handicapped parking spaces. That is based on the theory of a design and construction violation. The problem with that, first of all, is there was no evidence at trial that this building was designed or constructed for original occupancy after March of 1991. It just wasn't proven. There's also the problem that the Virginia statute makes it a offense to fail to design or construct in compliance with the accessibility requirements. And there's no evidence, of course, that these individual property owners had anything to do with the design and construction of this property. And, of course, finally, the Commonwealth didn't plead the design and construction case. They pled a reasonable accommodation question. And so none of the, or neither of the grounds that the Commonwealth proposes to avoid the clear problem we have with statute of limitations, I respectfully submit to file. And that takes us to the modification issue. First of all, the Commonwealth has said this morning and said in their brief that we're playing with a rule here because the association's rule said that they could create a disabled parking space in the general commonality. Respectfully, that's not what Rule 1.3 says. What 1.3 says is that the association...
What page in the joint appendix is that?
I'm sorry, sir.
What page is that in the joint appendix? Yes, sir.
The court found that a swap was arranged, that is,
The association got an owner to volunteer to give a parking space that Mrs. Bichelle said would have been great. It was right next to the elevator and was one of the handicapped spaces, offered to provide it to the Bichelles. And through the data trial, it would have still been available to the Bichelles. But the Bichelles rejected it because it wouldn't have been permanent. Essentially, they wanted something better than what they bought. They wanted something better than everybody else in the building. And that's not what the Fair Housing Law says. It says equal opportunity. The Bichelles were looking for something more. If I could, then, I'd like to turn to the question of sovereign immunity with respect to attorney's fees and with what we respectfully submit to the court was an error by the trial judge by failing to consider relevant factors. The doctrine of sovereign immunity, as this court has announced it on a number of occasions, is fairly simple and very clear. And I quote, a sovereign cannot be sued in its own court without its consent and permission. And what we have here is not an instance where the Commonwealth has been sued by the quite to the contrary. And this court has also stated the purposes for the sovereign immunity doctrine. It's to protect the public purse, just to ensure the smooth operation of government, to avoid officials being fearful to act, assuring that citizens will accept public jobs, prevent improper influence on government. None of those policy considerations are implicated when the Commonwealth is the party that files that lawsuit. Each and every one of them is expressly not at issue. So the clear language of the doctrine, as this court has announced it, and the policies behind it, I would argue, suggests that this court, that the doctrine of sovereign immunity does not preclude the recovery of attorney's fees and costs against the Commonwealth when the Commonwealth elects to sue its citizens. And so I would urge the court to conclude, and so far as I can find, the court has not yet addressed the issue, to conclude that the doctrine of sovereign immunity does not have application when the Commonwealth is the party that starts the lawsuit. The statute at issue here makes the Commonwealth the plaintiff in every case. That is, they cannot fail to be a party to the case. It is the Commonwealth that initiates the case. And that self-same statute says that the prevailing party is entitled, in the court's discretion, to recover its attorney's fees and costs. Here, the trial court correctly found that the doctrine of sovereign immunity does not apply to the Commonwealth as the plaintiff. But then, in our opinion, abused its discretion in denying the recovery of attorney's fees because it failed to consider relevant factors. The Commonwealth, in this case, identified a problem. The problem it identified was that a developer had conveyed away all the common element parking spaces, all the handicapped parking spaces. It's a problem that exists because the statutes of Virginia do not preclude a developer from doing exactly that. The Condominium Act expressly permits a declarer to convey the limited common elements that it identifies in its declaration. And yet the Commonwealth wrongfully chose to address this issue by suing its citizens of a residential association, despite knowing, because it spent a year and a half investigating the matter, despite knowing that the association had no power whatsoever to deal with those parking spaces in the garage building. Moreover, the Commonwealth
Council did the council for the condominium association ever challenge the Commonwealth before this lawsuit was filed by saying, you have no basis in law to pursue this, or this is being pursued in a vexatious manner?
Your Honor, I was counsel for the association at that time, and while it's not in the record, I can represent to you that that's exactly
what happened. Well, don't represent anything that's not in the record.
Very well, then I can't answer that question, sir.
And counsel, you indicate on page 34 of your brief that it was indeed vexatious, debilitating, time-consuming, and expensive, which I presume are the relevant factors which you were alleging the trial court did not consider.
No,
under our Landrum standard.
No, well, certainly under that opinion, Your Honor, but the factors that that I believe should have been considered were the ones that I had just begun suggesting, which is
Go ahead.
Which is that the Commonwealth knew that we had no power, knew that the parking space had taken day, knew that 557997 prevented us from doing anything to the rights of those property owners without their consent. It knew that the Fishells knew their parking space wouldn't satisfy them before they bought. They knew that the Fishells knew there was no handicap parking available at the time they purchased. And it knew that the Fishells made no inquiries whatsoever, even though they knew that there were 92 units in the building and only two handicap spaces.
And where in the transcript volume do you make those arguments, and where in the transcript volume does the court say, I hear your argument, but I am not going to consider those?
Your Honor, I can tell you that in the argument on attorney's fees, I wish I could tell you that I specifically touched on each one of these things, but I made the arguments to the court that it needed to consider in all the circumstances the unfairness of the case that had been brought by the Commonwealth.
Okay, thank you.
In all of these circumstances, Your Honor, we would ask the court, we would ask the court to sustain the correct decision of the trial judge in finding the statute of limitations that expired against the individuals, in finding that at its very best, the Commonwealth had made a modification case, not a reasonable accommodation case, did not comply with its pleadings, and that the court would find that it was error not to allow attorney's fees to win the trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You've used all your time. Call the next case, please.